I'm Gab. He's Don. Blue skies over West London. Now, if you're wondering why I'm coming to you over the magic of Zoom, well, that's easily explained. I have COVID, and Jules is on holiday. But that's okay. We're still bringing you a show. Thanks so much, Don, for coming in. We'll be talking about the Finalissima, the champions of Europe, taking on the champions of South America, fallout from Paris, Sadio Mane's future. But, Don, let's start at a match that you covered last night, near and dear to you as a former Scotland international. Scotland against Ukraine. I think it's fair to say that most neutrals generally like Scotland and will root for Scotland against most opponents. But I think last night, all the emotion and also probably a fair amount of technical superiority were with Ukrainians.
I think that's absolutely fair, Gab. Get well soon, by the way. It was a strange game because Ukraine started really fast, as you'd expect, because they were carrying so much emotion going into the game. But Scotland never got going. Technically, I thought Ukraine were better. Tactically, the manager was far superior. Had some fantastic players on the pitch. I thought Malinovsky and Zinchenko in the middle of the park absolutely ran the show, and Scotland couldn't get anywhere near them in the end. But they were comfortable, Gab. It wasn't like Ukraine went there and sort of defended a little bit and Scotland put them a little bit of pressure, maybe had 20 minutes in the second half. But in terms of how the game went, I mean, Ukraine were really, really comfortable. The scoreline didn't flatter them one bit. They were really good.
Well, we saw this Ukraine team at the Euros. I watched them in person several times, and there is some talent there. Maybe they're not on a par with past Ukraine side, but for me the big question here was how were they going to be prepared, because obviously, you know, many of these guys, the ones who are based in Ukraine, and it is a majority of the team, they hadn't played competitive club games since the invasion. They had a training camp in Slovenia. They played some friendlies against Borussia Mönchengladbach, against Empoli. But clearly not the ideal way to go and prepare for this game. So much emotion. We saw Zinchenko crying the day before the game. But is it fair to say that ultimately they show that it was a professional performance from them as well? They were the better side and they made a count.
Yeah, I think a lot in the modern-day football, Gab, as you know, I think we're all talking about the preparation. I mean, you know, preparation can go one or two ways. I mean, I've had games where you've been late for a game, your bus might have got stuck in traffic, and then literally 15 minutes later, you get off the bus, get changed and play, and you play well. So there's different sorts of preparation. Their motivation was obviously absolutely massive for them. Now, emotionally, that must have been difficult for the players to carry into this game. But at the same time, the prize was so big for them. And the atmosphere in Hampden was electric. It was really good. Once the game started, you try and put that to one side as a player, then you concentrate on the match, which they'd done really, really well. But I think you were just looking it aside when you watched the 90 minutes unfold that were far superior to Scotland. Scotland could never get going. The tactics that the manager tried in that game, he had four at the back. He had Stepanenko as the holding midfield player who absolutely bossed John McGinn. John McGinn couldn't think for himself. Steve Clark put John McGinn on the pitch in a position, in the number 10 position. But then he had to figure the problems out. Stepanenko just stood with him and he never sort of lost him. And then the four in front of that, and then the one guy up front who ran the channels was excellent. They had really good runners. They had lots of quality in midfield. And it was a poor showing. As I've watched Steve Clark's Scotland team over the years evolve. I remember going back to a game against Belgium in Brussels. It feels like 2 or 3 years ago. It might have been slightly longer. And they got beaten that game, but they competed really well. This was the poorest I'd seen Scotland play. And I don't believe that was down to the emotion from the Scotland players' end. I just think tactically, Ukraine was far better. They approached the game with more intensity. They put Scotland under so much more pressure. And they massively, massively deserved to win the game.
Yeah, they went 2-0 up. It felt like they could have added to it. Then obviously Scotland pulled one back before Ukraine scored on the counter in garbage time. Next up is Wales. Wales, who of course they played against Poland. They lost 2-1. It was a Nations League game. How do you see it going against Wales?
Difficult, because you don't know how much emotion and how much energy Ukraine put into that victory against Scotland last night. So can they recover? I expect they will. I think today might be one where they're sitting back and they feel absolutely shattered. But once they sort of refocus and go through one or two days of light training, Cardiff's going to be an amazing atmosphere. That'll be absolutely roaring. So it's something that Ukraine will have to be aware of. But I just think you're looking at a team and you're looking at a team that's fighting for such a big prize. I think, you know, I don't think there's too much between the sides. If anything, I'd have Ukraine slightly favourites, even though that's a slight contradiction because they are playing away from home in a hostile atmosphere. But they'll be used to it. The manager will prep them for that. But once the game kicks off, I think it'll be more or less the same as the Scotland game, where Wales have got technically one or two outstanding players. But team-wise, I think Ukraine will be too strong for them.
Yeah, and I think, again, it's going to be one of those games where most neutrals will be 100%, I think, with Ukraine. John, we don't want to put the cart ahead of the horse, as they say, but should Ukraine advance against Wales, should they qualify for the World Cup, there's going to be a weird situation where, you know, apart from those, I think it's 6-7 players, obviously Zinchenko at Manchester City, or Emchuk at Benfica, Malinovsky at Atalanta, but to get from now until November, those Dynamo Kiev players, what are they going to do? Dynamo Kiev and obviously other clubs in Ukraine, because it's going to be such an odd situation. I know UEFA are looking at different solutions, but what is it when you go 2-3 months without competitive games as a player? How does that affect you?
Hugely, because it knocks you out of your rhythm. I mean, you know, professional footballers these days are finely tuned athletes, and you have to keep going. You have to keep putting the minutes in. Your body clock has to be attuned to keeping fit and high-level football, intense high-level football. So, you know, sometimes a little break is good, but anything over sort of a week to 10 days, you'd start losing a little bit of rhythm. You might just get a little bit rusty. It's so difficult when we're talking about the Ukraine angle and the side of it and what they do and how they prepare and try and play friendly games and try and keep on top of things. That's before you even start worrying about the nutritional side of things, how much you're eating, how much you're taking in, how many calories you're burning, etc., etc. So for the players, it's going to be one where it must be so hard for the coaching staff, for the medical team, for the manager, for the coaches. It must be a really tricky one to try and navigate how you try and keep your players at really top level to play competitive football and play their best football.
One of the things we see in international football is players playing different positions to what they play in their club sides, and we see it with David Alaba when he plays for Austria. Playing in midfield, sometimes even as a number 10. And obviously we see it with Ukraine with Zinchenko. Now, it's slightly different with Zinchenko because he was an attacking midfielder. He was a number 10 before coming to Manchester City. Obviously at City, he's played left back. Ukraine have two Premier League caliber left backs in Zinchenko and Mykolenko. So he moves into midfield. But I'm guessing the transition for him moving from left back into central midfield, it's less of a stretch because of the way Manchester City normally plays. I mean, you often see Cancelo and Zinchenko stepping into the middle of the park anyway, right?
Yeah, absolutely. He made the game, Zinchenko, last night, Gab, look very, very easy because he's an intelligent player. I guess I would imagine with Zinchenko, and I would imagine with most Man City players, you've got to be able to take information on board from your manager. And the contradiction to that is I was watching John McGinn last night, and Steve Clarke put John McGinn into a number 10 position, and he more or less said to John McGinn, right, you're playing as a number 10. And their holder midfield player, their destroyer, Stepanenko, stood on him, and John McGinn couldn't really think for himself. He didn't know where to run. He didn't know how to take Stepanenko into different positions. So he was ineffective. I watched Zinchenko last night, as you know, playing left back for Man City, been a midfield player before. He stepped into the central position and just made the game look very, very easy. There was great rotation between him and Malinovsky and Stepanenko. Stepanenko had the brains to sort of go to the right-hand side. Then Malinovsky was coming in deep, as you saw for the Yarmolenko first goal, a long ball over the top, quality ball over the top, and the finish. But Zinchenko makes the game look very easy because he's got a good football brain and he takes information on well. He's been schooled by Guardiola. And going into that game last night must, for him, obviously it must have been difficult because you're switching positions, but I've been a player myself where I played so many different positions. It's quite enjoyable. It's almost like you're playing one position. I wouldn't say you get bored with it, but when you go into a different position, it's like, oh yeah, I quite fancy this. This is new. And you go into another one, it's like, oh yeah, I'll try my hand at this one. he's such an intelligent player.
Yeah, I think you need to have a certain attitude to do that, which you obviously had done.
Yeah.
A word on Scotland, and I was struck by this last night doing the FC show with Craig and Stevie. And the weird thing is, when you go on international duty, for some of these guys, like, and I say this with the greatest of respect, guys like Dykes up front and maybe Grant Hanley, when they play for Scotland, they're playing with a higher caliber of players than they are in their for their club sides.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if I'm Andy Robertson, I look up, and instead of getting the ball to Mo Salah and Sadio Mane, I'm getting it to Lyndon Dykes and Shea Adams, which is not quite the same thing.
No.
Can you talk a little bit about that transition? And is it difficult? Is it a big deal?
Yes, it's difficult, and it is a big deal. It's hard. As you said, if you're Andy Robertson, you've been tuned to finding Mo Salah for the last 3 years. So you bang it into his feet and you play the game from there. You're playing with Lyndon Dykes, no disrespect whatsoever, but he's one-dimensional. He's very good in the air. I think the first 5-10 minutes of the game, he won his flick-ons, but that was about it. He's not technically brilliant where you can wrap balls in at his feet, and midfield players like Billy Gilmore and McGregor can try and run off and join in. Shea Adams, I think, is a very good player, but better when he's running over the top. So I think I watched the Scotland game last night like I've been watching for quite a few years, and you think individually there's some really good players. I thought Aaron Hickey was the standout player for Scotland last night, playing at right wing back. I thought he was exceptional. He's had a brilliant season, as you know, with Bologna, but he was superb last night. But I think when you look at Scotland, what Steve Clarke's got to work with, and he's probably got 6 or 7 really, really good, strong players, the rest of it falls a little bit short. And one dimensional, I think, with one or two players, I think is the right term to use, because international level is a whole new ball game.
It is Sod's Law with Scotland. When, you know, you look at Robertson, you look at Tierney, you look at Hickey, yeah, he played on the right, but obviously he normally plays left back. You've got Tierney, of course, was injured, but when they're all fit, you've got three left backs, right?
I know. It's just, as you look, Scotland produced three unbelievable players. Where do they play? All play left back.
I wondered about that dynamic too, because there was one incident when at 2-1, you know, Scotland were charging. There was a situation where the ball fell. I mean, the reason I asked that about teammates and making the transition, it was a situation where the ball fell to Andy Robertson's weaker foot in the box. And instead of having a pop and even just kind of putting his laces through it from there, mm-hmm. You know, he tried to recover, tried to make a pass. I'm wondering again if that is kind of being on automatic playing for Liverpool, where you're in a great position in the box, it's on your weaker foot.
Yeah,
you'd still, for Liverpool, you'd still want to pass because there'll be other guys who are open, other guys who are here. Last night, you know, with hindsight, maybe he should have taken it, because odds are, if he tries to pass it, they're not going to get it back for a while.
Exactly. And that's your thought process when you play for Liverpool and you've got a ball that you think, oh, it's on my weaker right foot. Should I take a swing at it? Well, no, because there's Sadio Mane, there's Mo Salah, there's Firmino, there's Jota, there's Diaz, etc., etc. So you find the best solution. You work out and you problem solve. I always think with professional footballers, and I say it in commentary, and I try to say it not all of the time because it can get a little bit stale, but the whole essence of professional sport, whichever sport you're into, if you're watching Roland Garros, if you're watching tennis or golf, it's problem solving. And you watch Andy Robertson last night and he didn't find the best solution. He had a ball on his right foot. He could have found with Liverpool a better player. Last night, he must have been thinking, who do I look for? Oh, they're not there. I'll take the shot on. In the end, he got closed down and made the complete wrong decision. So he didn't problem solve in that second. John McGinn had the big chance, Gab. He had an open goal. Yes, it was at 2-0, so the scoreline might have been slightly different. It's not just like John McGinn scores, it would have been 2-2 because Ukraine had good chances in the game. But Scotland didn't manage the game last night, Gab. They weren't good at problem solving. It's like they played, they got put into a position. Can we go and beat Ukraine? Can you go and think for yourself? Can you problem solve? And Scotland, and not just Andy Robertson, but a fair few of them last night, they weren't good enough.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So, Gab, Finalissima was played last night. This is brand new to me. What is it?
Finalissima means ultimate final, and it's the winners of CONMEBOL, so South America, so the Copa America, which is Argentina, against the winners of the Euros, Italy. And, you know, Argentina trounced Italy. It finished 3-0, which is a shame for me personally, because had Italy won, I could have given it the big one and said, oh, that's all right. We don't need to go to Qatar because we're already the world champions, because obviously champions of Europe being champions of South America, nobody else has ever won a World Cup outside of those two confederations. Of course, I can't even do that because Italy had their rear ends handed to them by Argentina. It was a very one-sided game. I think Argentina, frankly, could have scored even more, Don.
What's happened to Italy? I mean, I know this is going to blow your mind, obviously, because, you know, like me, I'm working steady on. I love Italian football. And I just find from the Euros, the scenario over the last 18 months has just been a massive, massive letdown.
Look, I think it has been a massive letdown. I mean, we've done so many postmortems on why he didn't qualify for the World Cup. Again, I try to make it a point to separate performance from results whenever I can. And the results have been terrible. I don't think the performances have been that bad. And you can tie it back to the two games against Switzerland and the game against, where Jorginho missed penalties in both games. But Italy, I thought, easily had the upper hand in one of them. And against Bulgaria, where they mindlessly threw the game away when, you know, they could have scored 3 or 4. And again, against Macedonia in the playoffs as well, when they dominated, it looked like it was on the way to extra time. But, you know, it's football. You got to put the ball in the back of the net. Mm. This game against Argentina was different. We saw a tremendous Argentina side, Don. We saw an Italy side that, to me, looked like an end-of-season friendly for them. Mm. And then you can say this is all it was because this isn't a real competition. And by the way, for those who want to know about the history of the Finalissima, there's a political reading of it, which is UEFA and the president, Alexander Ceferin, and CONMEBOL and their president, Alejandro Dominguez, have kind of formed an alliance. They've opened an office in London for more cooperation between the two. The way perhaps some people see it of trying to balance out Gianni Infantino and FIFA, saying we can have our own competitions, we can plan our own stuff. So the game itself, while the versions of this had been played in the past, in the 80s and I think early 90s, you know, this competition is mostly about creating an event. The problem is, it was an event for Argentina. They were up for it. They weren't just technically better than Italy. They also ran more. Mm-hmm. They looked hungrier. For the Italian players, without a World Cup to look forward to, with some Nations League games now, which feel pretty anticlimactic, it felt as if kind of they were going through the motions. He played some of the guys that I don't think we're going to see again, people like Belotti up front, Chiellini obviously at the back. He's on his way to LAFC. But most of all, Argentina looks really good, Don.
And Are they back, Gab? I was reading that unbeaten in 2 years. Unbeaten in, what, 31?
I think they might say, Lionel Scaloni might say, Don, we've been back for a while. You just haven't noticed. But you know, Messi, I don't know if this was his best game of the past 9 months. It certainly was one of his best games. You know, he had that fire. There's such a great understanding with Angel Di Maria and Lautaro Martinez. At the back, they look very, very solid. They look very, very comfortable. And I'll tell you what, I think people are sleeping on Argentina a little bit when it comes to the World Cup. You know, I've got three teams that I put ahead of everybody else, which are Brazil, France, and Spain at this World Cup. But I look around and I factor in the fact that, you know, Lionel Messi, you know, we say, what condition is he going to be in going into the World Cup? Well, World Cup, they're going to get together in November, right?
Yeah.
He will have had a couple months of Ligue 1 football, which is not particularly taxing for him, especially if he doesn't want it to be. He's going to have some Champions League knockout games. But he can kind of really, really prepare physically for this tournament, likely to be his last World Cup. And I'm wondering, could that be enough to put Argentina over the top?
Oh, there you go. Gab said it. Argentina favourites for the World Cup.
Easy there. I'm not going to quite go that far, but it's obvious, I think, that I think we are sleeping on them, and I would put them maybe in that second group with England. Once it gets to the knockouts, you know, you don't need to be good all the time. You just need to be good for a couple weeks every 4 years to win a World Cup.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
All right, enough finalissima. How about some quick hits? More fallout from the chaos at the Stade de France for the Champions League final. Dawn, both UEFA and the French authorities are going to launch investigations. But in the meantime, we already know that one of the early claims that 40,000 Liverpool fans showed up with fake tickets is incorrect. It was actually less than 3,000, according to French police.
Well, 3,000 is 3,000 too many, but rightly so, having an investigation, Gab, because I had friends who were at the game outside the stadium, and you know, they were really, really edgy. They were quite nervy at some of the scenes that they were seeing. I mean, fake tickets is just absolutely ridiculous, but the scenarios that we saw outside the stadium in 2022 should never, ever happen. You should be able to go to a football match these days and be comfortable. I had a friend who was quite handy, shall we say, a boxer who's about 6'4", 6'5", can look after himself. And he said the scenes outside the stadium were quite chilling. He went, there was locals that were sort of trying to get at young kids and women and mugging and thieving, etc., etc. And the scenes outside the stadium were quite distressing. I mean, there was some brilliant quotes from some Real Madrid fans who I thought came across outstanding after the game, and they were saying if the Liverpool fans weren't as well behaved, there might have been one or two tragedies. So I think in the end, looking back at it, we were quite lucky that there was no fatalities, but there certainly has to be an investigation into what happened, because 40,000 fake tickets, as was alluded to, was obviously way, way off the mark, and that was a ludicrous thing for UEFA to try and put at the Liverpool fans. Well, it was outrageous, I thought.
I mean, to be fair, it wasn't UEFA. It was the French Interior Minister who came out and said this. I mean, you know, you said 3,000 fake tickets is 3,000 too many. I would agree. To be fair, I think a lot of these, it's not a case of Liverpool fans sitting on their computers at home and making fake tickets. It's people buying tickets on secondary markets and being sold fake tickets. I think that's that part of it, I think, is one thing which hopefully we can solve pretty simply. I think, you know, Liverpool as a club have handled themselves admirably, but one lesson that's obviously it's obvious to learn here is no more paper tickets. There's no reason these can't all be digital tickets. They were all digital tickets at the Euros. Liverpool chose to print tickets for whatever reason. I think we have to accept that, you know, in 2022, these need to be digital tickets, which are much harder to forge. But I think the other big thing is, I don't know that we'll get justice out of this. I just want us to learn a lesson here so that this never happens again, because this can't happen like this. It's great, man.
Same, totally agree. Gab, Milan have new owners. Redbird Capital have taken a majority stake in the club. $1.2
billion. Yeah, and if it sounds like a lot, it's, I think, because it is a lot. It's the second highest valuation of any football club that's been sold after Chelsea. Chelsea obviously sold very recently, and you know that's $1.2 billion for a club that doesn't have a stadium, you know, or certainly don't own their own stadium, of course. Although they do have a plan to do it. One of the interesting things is they're taking a majority stake, but the current owners, Elliot, are gonna stick around. I think that's very important in terms of continuity. I think it's very important also that Paolo Maldini and Ricky Massara are going to go and extend their contracts, which were expiring. So the deal is actually going to close in September. There are certain technical things that need to happen. But it's a big step, and Redbird Capital, of course, have a certain expertise in this. They are minority owners in Fenway Sports Group, who own Liverpool, and they also own Toulouse in France.
You'd like to think more investment on the pitch, then?
I still think they're gonna operate the way they've done before. They're gonna look for value. They're gonna try to be smart. It's not, you know, it's not a case of just writing checks. You can't do that in the modern game. But I think, you know, the way they showed with signings like Fernandes, Rafael Leao, Kalulu and whatnot, you know, they're pretty good at finding Salamakers, Manyan, they're pretty good at finding value. Bild are reporting that Bayern are prepared to offer 30 million euros for Sadio Mane, but Liverpool are holding out for 50 million. Don, given his age and his contractual situation, you think they'll just meet in the middle?
I think they probably will, but it feels like to me, and I know and I understand I'm going to be massively in the minority here, but I'd be all in to keeping Mane rather than Mo Salah. I think his form was incredible. I think he's never a problem to the manager. There's no stories. I think the job that he does for club and country is absolutely sensational. The work he does away from football, incredible. I don't know. It feels like a massive loss, this one, Gab, if they let Mane go. I think he's one of these players where he's dependable. When he first came in from Southampton, he played on the right-hand side. And then Mo Salah come in and Sadio Mane got shifted into a left-hand side position on the left side. Then Diaz come in, then he got shifted as a centre-forward. And he just plays all the positions incredibly well. And I understand, as I said, I'm going to be in the minority. But 30 million euros to me seems a little bit cheap. And this is, I wouldn't say worrying times, but it's times for Liverpool fans now because they are flying and they think they're really going places, which they are under Jurgen Klopp. To lose Sadio Mane, I honestly feels like, Gab, it could be a bit of a big blow.
Well, on the flip side, of course, if he doesn't extend, you lose him for nothing. And it's interesting what you say about Mohamed Salah and how maybe, you know, if you have to sacrifice, you sacrifice him. I don't know if Mohamed Salah has the same market at this stage. I'm not saying one player is better than the other, but the offer for Mane is there. The willingness of Mane to move on is there. Salah said he's going to be back next season. He hasn't said he's necessarily going to extend his contract, but he said he's going to be back. So I don't know. I think Liverpool they're just somewhat hamstrung on this. On the flip side, they got Diaz and Jota because they knew they were going to face the situation.
Okay, so on June 16th, Barca members are going to vote on a CVC deal, Gab. What are the implications here?
So essentially, CVC is a private equity group. They've signed a deal with virtually every other club in La Liga, but not with Real Madrid. Basically, the way it works, CVC, I'm really going to dumb this down. CVC say, okay, we're going to give each club a big lump of cash, some of which they can use on players, most of which they can use to upgrade their stadiums or whatnot. In exchange, I'm going to want a percentage of commercial income and media rights for, I think, it's the next 50 years. So in some ways, you're getting the money now, but some people say you're kind of mortgaging your future a little bit. The implications are important because Barcelona still have very severe spending cap restrictions. I'm not sure what the right decision is because there's so many elements. But basically, they need to do this. The argument to do this is going to be, we need to do this so that we can kickstart our summer transfer market. Sticking with Barcelona, multiple sources reporting that Manchester United are keen on Frankie de Jong, though maybe he's not so keen on moving. Does this make sense to you, Don? What would you do if you were Frankie?
if I was Frankie de Jong, I wouldn't go to Man United. I think Man City, if you're going to go anywhere, seems a better fit to me with their style. I think going into Man United at the minute under Ten Hag feels like a little bit of a lottery. We're not sure how much money and what quality of players are going to be coming through the door. I mean, obviously a brilliant player. So from Man United's point of view, I mean, why not target him? Because he's a brilliant player. And Ten Hag obviously knows him, and his style would certainly, and I say this loosely, fit Man United, but he's too good, in my opinion, for Man United. I think he's an absolutely wonderful player. Romelu Lukaku continues being linked with a move back to Inter. I mean, Romelu Lukaku's story again, Gab. What's going on here?
Well, basically, all we know so far is that his tax lawyer went and spoke to Inter, and he's willing to take a pay cut, something like 15% to 20%, to help facilitate a loan move. If that is what Chelsea want to do, it's not at all clear. They still have to meet with Tuchel. They have to meet with the new owners. So stay tuned. But he is willing to take a pay cut. Paul Pogba's time at Manchester United has come to an end, and he leaves the club as a free agent. Don, it's fair to say he didn't fulfill expectations, but he's not entirely to blame either. Since you love percentages, I want you to tell me how much is down to injuries, how much is down to the club and the managers he had, and how much is down to Pogba himself?
Oh, there's a lot of it down to Pogba himself, Gab. There has to be. I mean, I would imagine something like 75% down to Paul Pogba, because, you know, you take away the players that he's playing with, the different managers, etc. You've still got to be professional. You've still got to have pride in your performance. Doesn't matter what you do. If you're a professional footballer, you wake up every day and you're playing, obviously, for the badge on the front, but you're playing for the name on the back as well. You're representing yourself, your family, your reputation. So, I mean, only Man United could have a player, lose him on a free, pay £100 million for him and lose him on a free again. I mean, I don't know where he goes. I don't know what you think, whether it's PSG, whether it's back to Juve. There's a talented player in there, but to be considered the world's best, and I know the talent's there, and he's won a World Cup and he's won trophies, you have to be incredibly consistent. You look at people who play in this position, people like Luka Modric, 5 Champions Leagues, ridiculous amounts of titles and trophies behind him. You wonder why Paul Pogba can't get this thing going.
Maybe it's just all this hanging out with Jules that I've done, but I'm much more charitable towards Pogba than you are. I think the injuries played a big part. I think the zoo with the managers coming and going played a big part. And I think there's something about, and you might be able to relate to this, big, tall, central midfielders who've got a little bit of skill, when things go badly, they're often the ones who are targeted the most, aren't they, Don?
Why? I mean, he's still got so much ability, Gab. I mean, if someone asked me a question the other day, and you might be able to expand on it and say more, and someone said to me, name Paul Pogba's best games in a Man United shirt. And I said, the game against Man City, where I think he scored a brace and he was brilliant second half. And then you go, I think that's about it. I can't remember too many.
No, player of the season, and then when they won the Europa League. No?
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, I mean, and?
I think obviously there's some responsibility there. I also can't remember that many games where he was terrible and he gave off the vibe that he's not trying. I think a lot of it has to do with his price tag, with the way he looks on the pitch, and that sometimes prompts people to come out and accuse him of not even putting in effort. And I think certain players, maybe who stand out more, often have to deal with it. I've seen other United players really mail it in as well during this time.
Yeah, but not many have cost $100 million, though.
No, that's fine, but then let's come out and say there's a different standard for him. But you put in effort. I mean, on the performance side, sure. But the effort side, I don't know. I just think he's got to put up with a lot of crap that other people might not have put up with.
Gattuso may be back in the game. Hearing stories about maybe he's joining Peter Lim's Valencia gap.
Yeah, he's reportedly going to take over from Javier Bordalas. The deals, they have an agreement on principle. Gattuso now represented by George Mendes, and obviously George Mendes very close very close to Valencia and close to Peter Lim. It's always weird because, you know, in terms of style, Valencia fans have got to be among the most demanding in the world. And the fact that they've had to put up with Peter Lim and all this American nonsense all these years, part of me really feels for them. Bordalas was never going to be the answer simply because of his style of play, in my opinion. And then on top of that, the results didn't come either. What Gattuso does really, really well is he's really good at, he's a good man manager, and he's good at getting the fans to like him and then making everybody feel part of
connects,
a greater
isn't
whole.
He connects, doesn't he? Those Valencia fans.
Sorry?
He's a good connector, isn't he, between fans and players?
Oh, completely, completely. He'd be the first to say that. I mean, those Valencia fans who go out and kind of expect sparkling attacking football, I don't think you're going to get that necessarily from Gattuso. But I wish him well, and he's been very keen to go abroad. Obviously, he was linked to the Spurs job last year. Good for him. It's a new experience. It's only going to make him a better manager. But whether this is going to put Valencia over the top, I still think there's much deeper issues. And I think we're only going to see Valencia back for real once Peter Lim is just a bad memory. Lionel Messi says the best team doesn't always win the Champions League. John, is he needlessly trolling Real Madrid, or is he simply speaking the truth?
I think there's a little bit of both in there. Ex-Barca leaves a little bit on Real Madrid. Listen, I think when you look over the years, Gab, I think he's sort of got a point. I think everyone thought that Liverpool were favourites going into that game. I certainly did. I wasn't sure that Real Madrid's style could handle the pressing and the intensity of Liverpool. Maybe go back to Jose's Porto days. They probably weren't the best team in the tournament, but they got the job done. Di Matteo's Chelsea, they won the Champions League. They weren't the best team in the competition. But I think we've got to pay Real Madrid massive amount of respect. I mean, to do what they've done, I mean, I can remember going back to match day one or two when they got beat off Sheriff. And you think this team can no way win the Champions League. And they struggled against Inter in the group stages, scored a last-minute goal. They were poor in that game. But then you fast-forward a few months and you go, look at the sides that they've beat. I mean, teams like PSG, French champions, great team in Chelsea, Man City and Liverpool, the best teams in England. So I think it feels about right that Real Madrid won it, but I still think Lionel Messi is having a little dig, but in the back of his mind, he's thinking, were they the best team?
I don't know why this is so controversial or such a bizarre thing to say. I mean, Chelsea won it last year, and I didn't think they were the best team in Europe last year.
True.
But being the best and deserving to win are two different things. It's a knockout competition. There's no question. Because of what you said as well, Don, the teams they beat to get here, you can deserve to win something and not necessarily be the best team in Europe in that season. I think it's pretty simple. Real Madrid fully deserve this, but equally, I still think Manchester City and Liverpool are better sides.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So Chelsea, I mean, the ongoing story at Chelsea, Gab, Marina Granovskaya may be departing Chelsea soon.
Yeah, I obviously, you know, Todd Boehly and his group having taken over, that they suggested that, you know, maybe they might want to keep Marina Granovskaya. She's been such a huge part of Chelsea's success, Chelsea's ability to, I don't want to say balance the books, but get a lot of bang for buck out of their books in the last few years. And she's known as being very good with contracts and whatnot. There's certainly pressure from the government for her to move on. And I think that has to do with the fact that she's Russian. She may want to move on, also because she's due a bonus if she does move on. Interesting suggestion that the new owners seem to really like the sporting director at Atletico Madrid. It was actually an Italian guy, although he's been there for, God, feels like 10 years now, a guy named Andrea Berta. I think if he comes in, I think he's going to be much more as like a pure sporting director, and they'll still want to get somebody in to do contracts and more sort of the financial management side of things. Having missed out on Kylian Mbappe, Real Madrid are now linked to Richarlison. Don, as an Everton guy, you probably don't want to see this happen, but would it be a good option?
For Real Madrid or for Richarlison?
For both.
For Richarlison, it would be an unbelievable move. I think when you're coming down from potentially signing Kylian Mbappe to Richarlison, they're nowhere near the same player. They're not anywhere near the same levels. What I would say about Richarlison is towards the end of the season, and I questioned the attitude of and the character of quite a few Everton players, and I thought they were struggling at one point, Gab. I thought they were dead and buried. I didn't see any character in any leaders whatsoever. But I have to say, the last couple of months, I think Richarlison really, really led the line well. He showed his attitude. He showed the world what a good player he is. I just don't see consistency levels in him. I see a talent. I see a guy who I'm not sure in his best position just yet, if he's off the left or through the middle. So for the player, I mean, you'd be pushing for that move to leave Everton for Real Madrid. Of course you would. But in terms of him making Real Madrid a better team, I don't know if you agree, doesn't sit well with me, doesn't fit.
Well, he's not going to be Mbappe, obviously. But, I think they need another guy there. The nice thing about Richarlison is, you know, you could probably play him through the middle if Benzema needs a day off as well. Mm. They now need to find a solution. And he's a couple years younger than Mohamed Salah, who's, you know, one of the other guys they've been linked with. But it is a step up. But, you know, we're still talking about Brazilian international, possible World Cup winner in December.
Yeah. Gab, this is a tragic story. I mean, horrible in 2022, but my old boss, Alan Pardew, has resigned as technical director and coach of CSKA Sofia after his own fans racially abused some of his players.
It is an awful story. And I'll tell you what, I mean, you're going to tell me since you worked for him that he's a wonderful man and so on. I don't know the guy when he was over here. I didn't find him particularly likable. Some of the things he said and obviously some of the stories linked to him. But I have to say, massive kudos to Alan Pardew. He showed character. He showed integrity. He did the right thing. He made a stand. What happened here was CSKA were in the cup final. They lost. The fans were angry. A group of fans showed up at their next league game, and I think at the training ground as well, with bananas, hurling insults at some of the club's black players. And he just said, no, I'm not going to stand for this. I don't want to be a part of it. He's talked about how his experience in Bulgaria has been great. And, you know, he's met some wonderful people, worked with some wonderful people. By the way, kudos as well. Not many English coaches have the guts to go and work abroad or are willing to take that opportunity. He did, but he took a stand. And hopefully people will notice, and because this is entirely unacceptable. So while it is certainly tragic and horrible what happened, I also take the positives out of it, that people in the game are saying no more and we're not going to work under these circumstances. But tell me, is he actually a lovely man?
We didn't get on. We hated each other.
Oh, okay.
We actually hated each other. What I would say in all fairness to Alan Pardew is his coaching. And when he puts a tracksuit on, Gab, he's a very, very good coach. As an individual, he didn't get the best out of three or four of us, shall we say. Experienced players didn't like his attitude. A little bit flash, not for me.
Well, but I think on this occasion, he certainly redeemed himself.
Yeah.
The PFA have released their shortlist for Player of the Year. So there's Kevin De Bruyne, Sadio Mane, Cristiano Ronaldo, Mohamed Salah, Virgil van Dijk, and Harry Kane. Now, this is voted on by the players, and they return their ballots stupidly early. But still, you're a bit surprised there's no room at the end for Heung-min Son?
100%. 100% how Son is not in that conversation, I will never know. And I get it, when you win the big trophies, you're going to be propelled into that conversation. And I love Kevin De Bruyne. I think he's an amazing player. I think one of the best in the world. But my perception of last season, I don't know if you agree, was he had probably three or four really outstanding months. At the start of the season, he had an injury, couldn't really get any rhythm, wasn't playing at Kevin De Bruyne levels, I must say, not my level, Kevin De Bruyne levels. So how he's got in, I understand it because he's won the Premier League, of course, and went deep into the Champions League. I get it because he's a brilliant player. But for not to have Son in, Gab, seems a mystery to me.
I think I'm right in saying that what happens is these ballots get returned. I mean, they only announce it now, but the ballots get returned sort of stupidly early, like in April or something. And so actually, De Bruyne hadn't won the Premier League at that point. But maybe the fact that Son finished with a flurry of goals and Spurs got into the Champions League, the fact that that happened late maybe meant that he flew under the radar. a little bit earlier. But then if that's the case, then, you know, why is Harry Kane on there? So I don't know. To me, this is the least meaningful award. It should be more meaningful because these are footballers voting for their colleagues. Mm. But to me, there's just a lot of people who don't take it seriously. And I think some people got in here just on reputation.
Yeah. Well, this is going to interest me, Gab, being a Newcastle fan, because we're going to be linked with everyone in the summer. So Iran striker Hugo Etiquique, have I pronounced that right, is being linked with Newcastle. Jules loves him. Is he any good? Am I going to like him?
He's very young. Jules made the point that he's still raw. He's still kind of developing to be in the kind of player that he can be. He does so many things well. He holds the ball up. He's fast. He's intelligent. But he's still a developing player. I'm not going to lie. Jules has seen more of him. I've seen highlights of him. Mm. It's an interesting choice because obviously Newcastle tried to sign him in January. Rams kept him around. I think if the deal gets done, it's going to be, I think, in the 35 million range plus add-ons. It's going to mean, I would assume, that they're not going to go for Dominic Calvert-Lewin, who, of course, they've been linked with as well, because ultimately, in terms of strikers, you know, you've got Callum Wilson there, you've got Wood there, and now Etiquique. So I think they're laying down a marker, and they're saying, you know, we're not just going for big names, big reps, but we're looking for players who we think have a long-term upside. More PFA awards. How about that? The Young Player of the Year shortlist is Phil Foden, Connor Gallagher, Reece James, Jacob Ramsey, Bukayo Saka, and Emile Smith Rowe. Now, I'm going to say this right, Don. If I had a vote, it would be open and shut, and it would be Phil Foden. But feel free to disagree.
I will. I would have added probably Trent in there as well. But I think the standout player, I think, has been Connor Gallagher. I think he's been amazing, Gab. I think one that Thomas Tuchel has had a close eye on. I think Patrick Vieira's brought him on to different levels. I watch him and I think you are ready to go back to Chelsea and get in their first team and be a major player. Phil Foden, I mean, ridiculous player. I mean, you watch him and he's the one that at times makes the game look very easy. He flows, he's graceful when he takes players on, wonderful left foot, scores goals. These guys are in the conversation for a reason because they've all been brilliant. But I would lean towards Conor Gallagher, you know.
You make a good point on Trent. I can only assume that, I don't know, maybe they reckon, I don't know if he's aged out of it, although he's still quite young. Mm. I'd make a rule with a Young Player of the Year that you can only win it once. And so once you win it, you know, leave space to somebody else.
You can't win it twice. Is that the Gab rule?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're recognizing young talent. Let somebody else win it.
Fair enough. Sticking with the PFA awards, I hear Reece James' sister is a brilliant player and she's on the shortlist for the Women's Young Player of the Year award, even though she's only played 107 minutes, Gab.
I've already expressed my dysfunction and dislike for the PFA awards. The fact that, and look, Reece James' sister, her name is Lauren James. I think she's a year or two younger than he is. She was at Manchester United before. I'm sure she's a phenomenal footballer, but you should not be eligible to win an award when you've only played 107 minutes.
That's not right, is it?
I don't know who these voters are. I don't know if they're like, oh, look, I've heard of her or I've heard of her brother. Let me go and give her a vote. If that's what's happened, it's just silly. I think you need to actually play a season, and I don't think she should win it. But hey, these are the dysfunctions of the footballers' Footballer of the Year award. Manchester City will play Liverpool in the Community Shield on July 30th, but it won't be at Wembley, rather at the King Power Stadium in Leicester, because Wembley's being used for the Women's Euros. Don, do you care?
Not really, mate. You? I mean, does it matter? Community Shield final could be anywhere. Could be Old Trafford, Leicester, could be Cardiff, wherever you want to take it.
I mean, the only reason this might matter a little bit is, you know, you're not going to have 90,000 fans there. So maybe instead of Leicester, the King Power, could they have chosen a bigger stadium? Old Trafford springs to mind.
Yeah.
But, you know, no, I don't. I don't care. It's right. The Community Shield is not important. I know people in my country, in Italy, we love to, ooh, it's like the Super Cup. Oh, it's so important. They love counting it as trophies. It's not a trophy, not a real thing. So, no, nobody cares.
Yeah.
Go ahead, play it at Leicester.
I lost it. 5-4, I think, or 4-3 against Cantona's lead side. So I'm not bothered, mate. It doesn't really count. If I had won it, I would have said absolutely it matters. But I lost it. Right, what's happening? I'm reading in the Telegraph that Mike Riley could be replaced as a Premier League referee with Howard Webb as one of the candidates.
Yeah, look, I don't think it's a secret that it's been a rough year for Premier League referees, maybe even a rough couple of years. And according to the Telegraph, a lot of clubs are putting pressure on the PGMOL, which is the body that supplies and trains the referees for Premier League matches, to go and make some major changes. They're going to add the staffing levels. They're going to add, I think, a psychologist. They're going to overhaul the way they operate a little bit. I've met Mike Riley. I really, really, really like Mike Riley as a person. I think some of the problems they've had have to do with the fact that certain referees stuck around way too long. There's no age limits in the Premier League. And, you know, obviously we know that Moss and Atkinson, some of these guys are moving on. If there's going to be a generational change, maybe there could be a broader change. But, you know, if I were to ask you, I mean, you watch football from around Europe. Mm. Do you think the officiating in the Premier League the last 2 years has been as good as the football?
I think we're in my mind, obviously through COVID times and through new VAR times, I think these referees have had it tough. I certainly think when you're watching some of a lot of the games, decisions could be better. They could be made a lot quicker. I still think, I don't know if you agree, Gab, I think there has to be communication, whether that's via audio, to let the fans know what's happening inside the stadium. Because it feels odd to me that if you're sitting on the couch indoors, you've got more information watching a game of football on TV than you have if you're a paying customer inside the stadium. You're not really sure what's going on regarding VAR. I don't know if that's anything that you think could be done or improved on.
I mean, that I agree with you there. That's more of a procedural thing, I think. You know, it would certainly help. And to some degree, they tried doing this kind of unofficially by the broadcasters. They should explain when VAR intervenes and makes a certain decision about why that decision was made. But I think more generally, there is kind of a generational overhaul in Premier League referees. I think there's been a bunch of guys who, you know, have been around for a long, long time, well before VAR. I don't know that they're necessarily suited to operating in a VAR environment. And I think the PGMOL has to be empowered to make the changes that they feel that they need to make. And when you've got a bunch of older referees who've kind of been there, done that, I think it's harder to make those changes. You're going to be more conservative. Whether you need to change Mike Riley or not, or simply change the way the PGMOL operates, that's a question above my pay grade. But for me, the last couple seasons as a whole, have not been good.
Gab, is that a thing abroad when you watch Serie A and La Liga? You know, you mentioned there about the referees in England can play or can certainly play on and ref at a certain level for whatever age they want. Is there an age limit in Serie A, do you know?
Yeah, I mean, they follow the FIFA guidelines, which is 45.
Right.
And, you know, you've had... And then the reason they have those guidelines in place is... it's not so much that like you suddenly become a bad referee after 45, but it has to do with the legacy of officiating. It has to do with helping to develop kind of the next generation of referees, opening up spots for them. It has to do with the fact that, you know, refereeing is not really a lifetime career. So it's always the assumption, even though they're professional, that these guys are going to have other jobs that they're going to want to dedicate themselves to. I think one of the issues that once referees became professional, and you know, they could make a nice living in the Premier League, if they had side gigs, those kind of went by the wayside a little bit. And so, you know, these guys probably wanted to stick around past 45 a few more years so that they could make some money, because some of them, I think, weren't very clear on what they were going to do next. You know, they can't all go into the PGMOL or work on referee education. Gareth Southgate has said that maybe if England had shown more confidence and, quote, talked a bit more about winning the Euros from the start rather than just reaching the final, then they would have actually done it. Don, do you understand what he's saying?
I sort of get what he's saying, but how do you measure that? Like, oh yeah, like let's talk about it a little bit more. That means that might give us a little edge and we could actually win it. I don't know how you read too much into that, Gab, because if you talk about a competition and you say, yeah, we're going to win it and we're confident, and you lose it, you look like a bit of a numpty, you look like a little bit of an arrogant fool. So I understand why or what Gareth Southgate's saying. I think he wants his players to express a little bit more confidence and actually believe in themselves a little bit more. But at the same time, it feels a little bit dangerous. You don't want to be arrogant.
Yeah. I got two things to say to this. And look, and I say this as somebody who really genuinely likes Gareth Southgate, the
same
person.
Same.
Number one, you want him to be more confident and believe they can win it. And hey, look, you're the national team coach. Why don't you talk about it? Why don't you seize the responsibility? Why don't you come out and say we were semifinalists in the World Cup before? I think we can go and win this.
Pressure. Pressure.
Number two, just as important as that, it may be in the final. Don't make a bunch of defensive changes and sit back after score taking the lead so that you invite pressure forward from the other team.
Yeah.
Why don't you go and try to beat them? And instead, I kind of feel like he was way too defensive throughout the tournament.
I agree. Right. Pele has took to Instagram to send a message to Russian President Vladimir Putin calling for the end of the war in Ukraine and called the invasion wicked. Your take, Gab?
Like, I find this interesting because Pele's in his 80s, right? He doesn't need to do this. He really doesn't need to do this. He can sit back, enjoy his children, his grandchildren, whatever, enjoy the fact that, you know, he wakes up every day in his Pele. And yet he decides to go out and talk about this. He talked about how he met Vladimir Putin at the 2018 World Cup and whatever. I know people say that athletes shouldn't speak up about politics, or at least they used to say that. I think times have changed a little bit. I think a lot of people do. I think it's almost expected of people now. And well done to Pele. At his age, he can do whatever he wants. And personally, I like the fact that he's speaking out, because I think peace is a really important message here.
Absolutely.
Right, Don, that brings us to an end. Thank you so much for filling in for Jules. We're going to be back on Monday, or rather, COVID permitting, I'll be in a studio with Jules on Monday. But in any case, we will have a show for you. And until then, love the game, love your neighbor, love yourself.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate is to not search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.